Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover, in this audio, the first 15 verses of Daniel chapter 11. I will call this audio Wars Between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, Part 1. Now, chapter 11 has got to be the hardest chapter of any chapter I've done for the last several years in my New Testament podcast and now in the Old Testament podcast. This is really a killer. So I'm going to take it 15 verses at a time. And even so, each session will be pretty long. There's a lot of detailed history here. Daniel tracks that history so closely that liberals claim that someone wrote it after the fact, making Daniel, of course, a pious fraud. This tragic error is simply a matter of choosing a wrong proposition, that prophets can't prophesy, that the God who created the universe cannot give someone advance notice of history. Well, Daniel, in chapter 11, tracks the history of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. Those are the two most famous diadochi, the successors of Alexander the Great. He tracks this history all the way from Alexander the Great to Cleopatra, the famous Cleopatra, you know, with Claudette Colbert, the old movie, and the new movie with Elizabeth Taylor, the famous Cleopatra in Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar. Daniel even tells of dealings between Cleopatra and Herod the Great at the end of the chapter. So there's a lot of history that Daniel moves in and out of in this chapter, secular history. I'm only going to cover 15 verses in each audio. I'm going to finish Daniel 11 in three audios, I hope. One might easily get lost in the details. Now, some sources for background reading which will help much. I'm going to give you these so that perhaps in your spare time when you're not raising a family, going to a job, changing kids' diapers, watching NFL football, you can find some time to look into this. It's very interesting history, but it's difficult history. And there's not a lot of sources on it. Everybody loves to talk about Alexander the Great. But then after Alexander the Great died, nobody really cares about writing history too much. And then, of course, the Romans, at the end of the Diadochi period, the Hellenistic period, the Romans take over. And everybody wants to write about the Romans, but nobody wants to write about what happened in between. And this is what happened in between. Well, Daniel doesn't care about what secular historians care about. He cares about what's going to happen to the Jews. And we'll see that these wars affect the Jews. Very much so. The Ptolemies are in Egypt, and the Seleucids are in Syria. Egypt's to the south of Israel, and Syria's to the north of Israel. And Israel was like Poland is to the east and the west, a battleground. Here's some sources on background reading. Wikipedia. Look up the article on the Syrian wars. You'll see all the individual emperors listed there that I'm going to mention here as we talk about the kings of the north and the kings of the south. There's a more modern book written in the 21st century by Bob Minnett and Mike Roberts, The Wars of Alexander's Successors. That only takes you down to 281 BC. That was volume 1. I haven't seen that volume 2's ever come out. Then there's another book, only cost a couple hundred bucks, John D. Granger, The Syrian Wars, 2010. That covers the whole period, but like I say, the only version I saw was frightfully expensive. And then there's an old book by a gentleman named Edmund Robert Bevan, B-E-V-A-N, I guess is how you say his name. He's British. He wrote a book called The House of Seleucus, 358 to 251. It's in two volumes. It gives you all kinds of details, but again, it only goes down to 251. Doesn't go down to the end of the Seleucid Empire when the Romans wiped them out, but it's still a very good book, and it's free at the Internet Archive. I've got a copy on my phone. And then Edward Robert Bevan, The House of Ptolemy, that's free for download. I've got the site here. You can get it from the notes, which you can get off my website at www.prettygoodbiblestudies.org. You can get all my notes, and in the notes there, you'll see a link, and it has the whole book that you can get for free. And there's no way you're going to keep up with all the details as I speak. Instead, if you would, please focus on how closely Daniel follows the history. The details I do give you should be a good launch pad for further study. I've tried to condense a lot of stuff in a short period of time, and I've had to leave out a lot of stuff, and a lot of it I don't know yet. I just know the basic outlines. You can get lost in this stuff. But once you know the names of the players, you can look them up in history. And in fact, I'm going to give you the entire name as well as the reign dates of each king. I know that a lot of historians don't do that. They just say, oh, Ptolemy did this. Well, which Ptolemy? There's 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 of them. It just irritates me. So I'm going to give you the name of the king, his number, and also his nickname. A little bit clumsy, but it will help us stay oriented. Now with that introduction, we can start with Daniel 11:1. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to strengthen and protect him. Well, there's our mysterious Darius the Mede again. Well, whoever he was, the year was 539 B.C. the year that Gabriel stood up. I assume it's Gabriel who stood up and protected Arius the Mede. It does not say this is when the prophecy was given, but it does say that this is when Gabriel, or I, stood up to protect Darius the Mede. That we know was 539, because in Daniel 5:30 through 31, we read that very night Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Belshazzar was killed in 539 as the Persians conquered Babylon. That's a strong date. Nobody disagrees with that. Now, Darius the Mede can either be, according to conservative scholars, he could have been a king of Babylon who ruled before Cyrus took over. That's if he was Cyaxares II, who some think was an emperor before Cyrus. I think it's a question of, do you quote Xenophon or do you quote Herodotus? Xenophon has Cyaxares II 2 But on the other hand, he could be Darius the Mede, could be Gubaru. This is Gleason Archer's suggestion in his Yellow Bible. And if so, then Gubaru would not be the emperor of the whole empire. He'd be the governor of the province of Babylon under the Persian emperor Cyrus the Great, who took over in 539. But I've gone all over that in chapter 5. We're not going to do that again. It doesn't really matter for this chapter. Now, I stood up to strengthen and protect him. That could be Daniel. But why would Daniel be trying to protect Darius the Mede? Seems a little strange to me. Well, the answer to that, I think, is that Gabriel is still speaking. Chapter 11, verse 1 should be the last verse of Daniel 10. Daniel 10, verse 21, second part of the verse says, I will tell you what is recorded in the book of truth. And that I, of course, is Gabriel speaking to Daniel. But you could take it as Daniel trying to stand up to protect the new governor of the Babylonian province, if it's Gubaru, or the new kingdom of Babylon, if it's Cyrus the Great, if it's an emperor before Cyrus. Now let's forget who Darius the Mede is here, and let's point out that the fact he is mentioned tends to tie the events that we're going to talk about in this chapter to the 70 weeks. Because in chapter 9, which is the chapter, the last four verses of that chapter, told us, that is the chapter that told us about the 70 weeks, which starts with 457 decree of Artaxerxes to go back and build the temple. 490 years later, 70 weeks. The middle of that last week ends up right there at AD 30 when Jesus was crucified. We talked all about that in chapter 9. Well, that's a long period of time. What's going to happen in those 70 weeks? Well, here we have a whole bunch of stuff that's happening within the 70 weeks. The Syrian wars. The wars of the Diadochi between the death of Alexander the Great in 323 till the death of Cleopatra in 30. And then Herod kicks in there too until 4 BC. And we're right up to the end of the 70 weeks when Jesus was killed in the middle of it. At AD 30. So it all fits. Well, how do we make that connection? Well, in Daniel 9:1, we read, in the first year of Darius, a Mede by birth, and so the 70 weeks chapter is given in the first year of Darius the Mede. Then we go to Daniel 11, and we have Darius the Mede mentioned, although the prophecy wasn't mentioned there. The prophecy actually is in the third year of Cyrus. We see that as we go back to Daniel 10, verse 1, which is an introductory chapter to verse chapters 11 and 12. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel. All right, so the 70 weeks and the Syrian wars, the great conflict that's going to be taking place here, are linked together. And in Daniel 10:1, which is the introductory chapter to chapter 11 and 12, we see that the message was true and was about a great conflict. That's Daniel 10:1, first part of the verse. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel. The message was true and was about a great conflict. Now, the six Syrian wars that are described in chapter 11 were indeed a great conflict. And Israel was geographically right between the Ptolemies to the south and the Seleucids to the north. So it makes sense that Daniel would prophesy about this. The six Syrian wars are extremely relevant to the history of the Jews. We go now to verse 2. Gabriel continues speaking to Daniel. Now, I will tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth will be far richer than the others. By the power he gains through his riches, he will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. So Gabriel tells Daniel that three more kings are going to arise in Persia, three more than Cyrus. This prophecy was written in the third year of Cyrus. Cyrus ruled Babylon from 539 to 530, so the third year of his rule in Babylon was about 536, 535 or so. Again, the way we know that this time period of this prophecy was in the third year of Cyrus is because in Daniel 10:1, it says, in the third year of Cyrus, a message was revealed to Daniel. And so the three more kings would be three kings after Cyrus. The next three kings, Cambyses II, he ruled from 530 to 522. He was the son of Cyrus. And then in 522, for a brief period of time during that year, there was a fake king, an imposter named Pseudo-Smerdis. I love that name. He was also known as Gamata the Magician. Some people called him Bardia. I just remember him as Pseudo-Smerdis. And then after Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius I the Great takes over, 522 to 486. He's the same Darius that fought, or his troops fought, the Battle of Marathon in 490, the famous battle against the Greeks, in which the Persians were whooped. But then Gabriel tells Daniel a fourth king will arise, and he will be far richer than the other three. That, of course, is the next king, Xerxes I. He was famous for being rich. His reign dates were from 486, when Darius died, to 465. To show you how rich he was, let's discuss his attempts to invade Greece to make up for the disastrous Battle of Marathon. He was preparing to attack Greece at the Battle of Salamis in 480, and his troops later in 479, they lost both of those battles, and that's when Greece became independent of Persia. And as he's getting ready to go fight the Battle of Salamis, he goes through Lydia, Western Asia Minor, and he meets a guy named Pythias, who at the time was the richest king in the world. This is according to Herodotus. Benson tells us the story. Pythias the Lydian was at that time the richest subject in the world. He generously entertained Xerxes and all his army and proffered him 2,000 talents of silver and 3,993,000 pieces of gold with a stamp of Darius toward defraying the charges of the war. But Xerxes was so far from wanting supplies that he rewarded Pythias for his liberality and presented him with 7,000 darics to make up his number a complete round sum of 4 million. I have no idea how much this is worth, but you can tell it's a lot of money. Each of these darics was worth better than a guinea of our money. I suppose that's British money. Many great and rich provinces as India, Thrace, Macedonia, and the islands of the Ionian Sea were added by Darius, who of course was Xerxes' father, to the Persian Empire. So Xerxes was very rich. And by the way, this is the same Xerxes who's Ahasuerus in the Book of Esther. Now, some people reckon him as the fourth king in different ways. I just gave you Cambyses II, Pseudo-Smerdis, Darius is the first three, and then Xerxes, number four. But since Pseudo-Smerdis was a fake, and he didn't last but a short period of time, some people start with Cyrus, and then go to number one, and then go to Cambyses as number two, Darius the Great is number three, and Xerxes number four. Either way, you end up with Xerxes as the fourth king. I prefer to count Pseudo-Smerdis. He fooled a lot of people. Why not? So now we read in verse 2 that Xerxes, the fourth king, the rich king, will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. And oh, did he do that? It's written in Herodotus. This is classic ancient history. Anybody that knows anything about ancient history knows about this. We know that Darius the Great, who ruled from 522 to 486, he tasked his son Xerxes, who ruled from 486 to 465, to destroy Greece. He wanted revenge because the Greeks had beaten the Persians at Marathon in 490. So Xerxes starts making preparations for war against the Greeks starting in 483. He raised money. He accumulated provisions. He dug a channel through the isthmus of Mount Athos. Now, Mount Athos was on a promontory of rock right there at the northeastern corner of Greece, and the ships to get around it would go out into the Aegean Sea there, and the weather was bad, the currents were bad, and there was a shipwreck, I think, if I remember correctly. Darius the Great lost, I'm almost sure I remember this correctly, he lost a great fleet there, and Xerxes didn't want that to happen again, so instead of going around the promontory of rock, he just cut a channel behind it, through it. Can you imagine how long that took and how much it cost? Xerxes stored supplies all along the road through Thrace, which is northeast of Macedon, and Macedon's north of Greece. Xerxes built two bridges across the Hellespont. The Hellespont, of course, is the place later called the Dardanelles, the Bridge of Greece. It got you from Asia Minor over into Thrace, over into Europe, going from Asia to Europe. Xerxes entered into alliances with Carthage and other Greek states to try to beat Athens. He gathered a large naval fleet, and he raised a 2-million-man army. Now people can debate all these numbers all they want, but the point was, this army was extremely impressive. I've read the description of it, and how it just awed everybody. So yeah, Daniel is exactly right. Xerxes will stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. We'll go now to verse 3, or before we go to verse 3, let's take a historical note. Xerxes was beaten at Salamis in 480. It's a great battle. He's sitting up there over the bay watching his ships that had gotten suckered into the bay and they couldn't get out. And it was one of his queens. I forgot her name, but she was the queen of a little tiny kingdom on the southwestern corner of Asia Minor. And she fought valiantly and managed to escape, took down some ships, I think, some Greek ships. But he was embarrassed, Xerxes was, as he was sitting up there on his throne. He went back to Persia. He'd sent some more troops to Greece. They got beat at Plataea in 479 the next year. And after that, that was it for the Persians. They left him alone, basically. And that marked the rise of the Athenian Empire, which was founded 2 years after Plataea in 477 B.C., And for some historical context, Socrates was born in 469. So, Daniel's right in the middle of the history here. We go to Daniel 11:3. Then a warrior king will arise. He will rule a vast realm and do whatever he wants. That warrior king was Alexander the Great, who ruled from 336 to 323. He, of course, was from Macedonia, north of Greece. He ended up defeating the Persian king Darius III, Cotomanus, or Darius, depending on how you want to pronounce it, Darius III, Cotomanus, who ruled from 336 to 330. So right in the middle of Darius's reign, Darius III's reign, at the Battle of Issus in 333, Alexander whooped him. That's when he captured his wife and acted very chivalrously toward him and didn't sexually violate her. Chivalry was not dead yet. Issus was on the Mediterranean coast in what are now southeast Turkey, right there in the northeastern bend of the Mediterranean Sea. But that defeat in 333 B.C. marked the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. And so this warrior king will end up ruling a vast realm. Now, Daniel was exactly right about that because Alexander's kingdom reached from Macedonia, north of Greece, to Bactria, present-day Afghanistan, Sogdiana, which is Central Asia, Turkmenistan, I forgot exactly which stan it was, Tajikistan, and then all the way over to India. This is well-known history. You should read a biography of Alexander the Great just for fun. Well-known history. We go down to Daniel 11:4. But as soon as he is established, that's Alexander the Great, his kingdom will be broken up and divided to the four winds of heaven, but not to his descendants. It will not be the same kingdom that he ruled, because his kingdom will be uprooted and he will go to others beside them. As soon as he is established, Alexander only lasted 13 years from 336 to 323. He died of a fever in Babylon after his conquest. His kingdom will be broken up and divided to the four winds. By 301 B.C., sort of a famous Battle of Issus, the generals had finished fighting each other, and Alexander the Great's kingdom had been divided up four ways. Now, the two most stable quarter portions were Egypt, which is ruled by the Ptolemies, and the Seleucids, which is basically the East, Syria, Babylon, and Persia. And then Greece itself was ruled over by a guy named Cassander, and Asia Minor, which originally was ruled over by Lysimachus. Lysimachus and his allies beat Antigonus I at the Battle of Ipsus in 301. Now, Antigonus had been hanging around for a while, but he got beat. So I guess 301 is a good year to finally look at how the fighting, which is extraordinarily complicated, by the way, the fighting between the successor generals of Alexander the Great, the so-called Diadochi. It's enough to drive you crazy. But this is what happened. You got Greece, Asia Minor, Syria, Babylon, and Persia, and you got the Holy Land, and you got Egypt. At first, the Holy Land was under the Ptolemies. It became a football after a while, as we'll see. So the kingdom is divided to the four winds of heaven, but not to his descendants. That's because Alexander didn't have any descendants that could inherit. He had a baby in the womb, an illegitimate baby. He had a half-witted son, a legitimate son, but he wasn't able to rule. And so Alexander's generals, not any son, inherited the pieces of the empire. Alexander had made no succession arrangements. I guess he thought he was a god. Gods don't die. He was young. Young people don't ever think they're going to die. He'd conquered the world. He'd been through battles. Nobody ever killed him. But finally a bug got him. Something killed him. Some disease. Now, to show how there were no descendants left for Alexander the Great, as a result of the struggles that occurred at Alexander's death, the following of Alexander's relatives were also soon dead. His mother, his wife, his son, his illegitimate son, his sister, his half-sister, and his half-brother. He should have made a will. Good application point. You got a wife, you got kids, you got a car, you got a house. You better make a will. Verse 4, the four kingdoms are not the same kingdom that Alexander ruled. It, meaning the former kingdom, will not be the same kingdom that formerly Alexander ruled. Why? Because they're all divided up and they're not as big. Because his kingdom will be uprooted and will go to others besides them, besides his descendants. That them is a little bit confusing, but it refers to Alexander's descendants, as the NASB 95 note says. We go now to Daniel 11:5. The king of the south will grow powerful, but one of his commanders will grow more powerful and will rule a kingdom greater than his. Now the king of the south is Ptolemy Lagus, also known as Ptolemy the First Soter. Soter means savior. He ruled from 305, or maybe 304, to 282. He's the founding king of the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. Lagus was his father's name, by the way. That's why they call him Ptolemy Lagus. Sometimes this whole dynasty is called the Lagid dynasty. It lasted all the way down to Cleopatra, who died in 30 BC. He was, of course, one of Alexander the Great's military officers. He actually took the Egyptian title of Pharaoh because he was head of Pharaoh now, because he was head of Egypt now. He began a dynasty that would last for nearly 300 years. He was the friend and biographer of Alexander the Great. Why is he called King of the South? Well, that's because of the geographical relationship with Israel. The kings of the north, king of the south, kings of the north of the Seleucids, or the Seleucids. I'm going to say both. Seleucid is Greek. Seleucid is the English transliteration. Seleucid is the Greek, and Seleucid is the English transliteration. Now, Ptolemy the First Lagus, Ptolemy the First Soter, will grow powerful, as Daniel says in verse 5, the king of the south. Here are the regions that Ptolemy the First Lagus ruled. Egypt, Libya, which is just to the west of the Nile River, west of Egypt. Cyrene, which is the Greek trading city that was built in Libya. Ethiopia, which is the south of Egypt. Arabia, which is the east of Egypt, across the Red Sea. Also to the north and east toward Israel, which is Arabia Petraea, as they called it back then. Ptolemy ruled that. Phoenicia, now we're going up the Mediterranean coast all the way up to present-day Lebanon, which, of course, includes the Holy Land. As I said, Israel was part of Ptolemy's reign to start with. The football, the political football that Israel was. Ptolemy ruled Coelia Syria, which is the area between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon range in Phoenicia and Lebanon. Phoenicia was sort of on the coast. Coelia Syria was further to the east. Then Cyprus, that island in the northwest corner of the Mediterranean Sea, and several isles in the Aegean Sea, those rocky islands between Greece and Turkey. He also, Ptolemy did, had many cities in Egypt. So you see, it was not just Egypt, but he was spread out a little bit from Egypt. He was powerful, but one of his commanders will grow more powerful. The commander, this is easy, Seleucus the First Nicator. I've got a picture of him here. I know you can't see him, but he is one mean-looking dude. He ruled from 305 to 281. He was one of Alexander the Great's military officers. He started out working for Ptolemy Lagus, Ptolemy the First Soter in Egypt. But then he became stronger than Ptolemy First Soter. He ended up with a great dominion. In fact, his name, Nicator, means conqueror, Seleucus I the Conqueror. He is reputed to have had 72 kingdoms placed under his authority. He founded the Seleucid Empire, the Seleucid Empire. He's the George Washington of the Seleucids. In fact, he gave his name to the Seleucid Empire. That's why it's called that, Seleucus I Nicator. Now, here's the extent of his rule, all the way from Macedonia, which is right north of Greece, and Greece itself, and then Thrace, which is to the northeast of Macedonia, going around to the north of the Aegean Sea, cross the Hellespont, go into Asia, into Anatolia, present-day Turkey. He had that too. Oh, then keep going around the Mediterranean Sea, dip down south a little bit, and you're in Syria. Keep going east. You're in the Mesopotamian Valley between the Tigris and the Euphrates, Babylonia. He owned that. Go east of the Tigris, north of the Persian Plateau is Media. He owned that. In fact, keep going. All of the eastern countries as far as India, Seleucus I Nicator had dominion over. So, once again, Daniel is prophesying exactly right. Ptolemy was powerful, but one of his commanders used to work for him. Seleucus I Nicator became more powerful. We go now to Daniel 11:6. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to seal the agreement. She will not retain power, and his strength will not endure. She will be given up, together with her entourage, her father, and the one who supported her during those times. Now, Daniel says, after some years, they will form an alliance. They is the king of the north and the king of the south, but the two kings have changed names now. They're different kings of the north and different of the south. This alliance was formed at the end of the Second Syrian War, which was fought between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids between 260 and 253. The two kings were weary of fighting. Well, who are the two kings? Well, the king of the south is Ptolemy II Philadelphus, who ruled from 285 to 246. He sent his daughter Berenice to marry Antiochus II Theos, who ruled from 261 to 246. It is more than a coincidence that those two kings died in the same year. Now, Wikipedia says that this marriage alliance was carried out between the north and the south, Ptolemy and the Seleucids, in 252. Now, what happened was this. For years, since Alexander the Great's death in 323, wars had raged between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. And in 253 or so, at the end of the Second Syrian War, after 13 years of fighting, the two kings were tired. So they said, let's make a peace treaty. And so Ptolemy II Philadelphus had a daughter, Berenice. Antiochus II Theos was a young man. He's ruling the Seleucid Empire. So they decided to patch things up and have a marriage license. There was only one problem. Antiochus II Theos, which means God, by the way, Antiochus the God, he was already married to a woman named Laodice. So he had incentive to put her away because of the peace that he wanted, and so he put her away. He wanted to regain some territory that he had lost in the Second Syrian War, and the peace treaty would allow that. And so if you got a wife, you got some property, maybe the property's better than the wife, and so he ditched her. Bad mistake. So he takes the new Egyptian wife, the daughter of Ptolemy II Philadelphus. Berenice is her name, also known as Berenice Syra, also known as Berenice Phrenophorus, which means dowry bearer. She comes on up to Daphne, which is near Antioch, the stomping grounds of the Seleucid emperors, and she marries Antiochus II Theos. So Daniel says after some years they would form an alliance. That's exactly what happened. The daughter of the king of the south would go to the king of the north. The daughter is Berenice. The king of the south is Ptolemy II Philadelphus, and the king of the north is Antiochus II Theos. So Daniel's got it right on the money. Now let's talk a little bit about the two kings. Ptolemy II Philadelphus, the king of the south, he was the second, and he was the greatest of the Lagid dynasty. Ptolemy I Lagid started the dynasty. We talked about him already. The Lagid dynasty, the Ptolemaic dynasty. Ptolemy number two was the greatest. Now, his reign dates start earlier than the end date of Ptolemy I, Ptolemy I Soter. Ptolemy I Soter, Ptolemy Lagus, he finished ruling in 282. Ptolemy II Philadelphus started reigning in 285. So he had a three-year co-regency with his father. Now, he's noted for his cultural achievements, Ptolemy II Philadelphus is. He collected many books and put them into his library at Alexandria, the very famous library, which unfortunately got burnt down in antiquity sometime. I'm not sure they even know when, but it was a terrible disaster. And for Christians, and for Jews too, I suppose, he's famous because he got the Law of Moses translated from Hebrew into Greek. Just the Law of Moses, not the rest of the Old Testament, not the rest of the Hebrew Scriptures. They were translated about 100 years later in the 2nd century B.C., according to Britannica, the Encyclopedia Britannica. The total result of all that translation work was the Septuagint. But he got the ball started, so he's famous for that. Now, the king of the north, Antiochus II Theos, he's the third Seleucid king. The first was Seleucus I Nicator, the conqueror, from 305 to 281. He reigned. He was the founder of the Seleucid dynasty. And then Antiochus I Soter, the savior, comes next. He's 281 to 261. We don't know too much about him. I mean, people know about him, but Daniel doesn't talk about him too much. But Antiochus I Soter had a son named Antiochus II Theos. He ruled from 261 to 246, and he's the guy that marries Berenice from Egypt. Now, verse 6 in Daniel 11 says that Berenice, she will not retain power. What did Daniel mean by that? Or what did Gabriel mean by that when he told Daniel? This is how Berenice lost her power. Her father, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, died in 246 B.C., whereupon Antiochus II Theos says, the man behind his daughter, and Ptolemy II Philadelphus loved his daughter. But he's gone now, and now Antiochus II Theos has a chance to make some hay against the Ptolemies, and so he repudiates Ptolemy II Philadelphus' daughter Berenice, repudiates her and their infant son who was due to inherit the throne. The infant son was named Antiochus III. So what does Antiochus II Theos do after he ditches Berenice, his Egyptian wife? He goes back to his first wife, Laodice. Now, you know what Shakespeare said about hell hath no fury like a woman spurned. Well, Laodice had been spurned, and just because she was taken back did not mean that she trusted her husband Antiochus II Theos. In fact, she didn't, and she poisoned him. And so that's why Antiochus II Theos died in 246, the same year that Ptolemy II Philadelphus died. So Laodice, having poisoned her husband, she places her son, Seleucus II Callinicus, on the throne. And Callinicus died from 246, and Seleucus II Callinicus ruled from 246 to 225 B.C. He was persuaded by his mom to kill Berenice and her infant son, which was done. And so Berenice exits from the stage of life. And so Daniel's prophecy was perfectly fulfilled when Daniel, in verse 6, chapter 11, says, "She, Berenice, will not retain power." Now, he finishes off his sentence there and says, "His strength will not endure." Now, who does the "his" refer to? Whose strength? Well, it's probably Antiochus II Theos, the king of the north who had been poisoned by Laodice, as I just said. So his strength was cut off by being killed. It could be that the person's strength who was cut off was the king of Egypt, who had just died, Ptolemy II Philadelphus. His arm was cut off. Berenice was his arm. The literal translation there is not strength, but it's his arm will not endure. Ptolemy II Philadelphus's arm, his strength, Berenice, will not endure. Could be. I think it's Antiochus II Theos whose strength will not endure because he was killed. Daniel continues in verse 6, "She will be given up, Laodice." Daniel continues in verse 6, "She will be given up, Berenice will, together with her entourage." Her entourage means the people who brought her up into Syria from Egypt. They were all killed. Now that's one option. That's the option I prefer. Berenice's attendants, who had brought her to Syria, were killed at Daphne with Berenice. Daphne is a place near Antioch. It's a great story. I just read in Wikipedia. Berenice doesn't know that her little baby son, Antiochus III, had been murdered. And she's begging with a magistrate there to put her back on the throne, put her son on the throne, not Laodice's son, Seleucus II Callinicus. The magistrate was given a grief, I guess, because Berenice just whacks him and kills him right in front of the crowd, and then she makes a big speech. Great history here. But at any rate, she doesn't make it. So she's killed. Her entourage is killed. Now, it could be that the entourage who was given up is what Daniel says, given up, didn't say killed. He said given up. Could be the people back in Egypt who had plotted to put Berenice on the throne through that marriage treaty. Could be, but I think it's the people who brought her to Egypt. They all got killed at the Daphne massacre there. Now at the end of verse 6, we also read that Berenice's father was given up. Now there's a translation issue here, so let me give you some different translations. The Holman Christian Study Bible note says some Hebrew manuscripts say father, that's what they mean, but Theodotion read the child. Theodotion was a scholar who translated the Masoretic text, maybe from the Septuagint, maybe from the Masoretic text. They're not really sure, but he is what scholars use instead of the Septuagint because there are only two Septuagint manuscripts of Daniel. For what reason, I don't know. One was found in 1770 and one was found in 1931. So the scholars can't really go back to the Septuagint, so sometimes they use Theodotion. Well, Theodotion says the child, not the father. The Syriac and the Vulgate read her children, plural. Young's Literal Translation has her child was given up. The American Standard Version, the Darby Translation, and the KJV say he that begat her gave her up, in other words, her father. The Bible in Basic English says her son was given up. God's Word translation says the one who fathered her was given up, but God's Word note says most Hebrew manuscripts say her father was given up, but one Hebrew manuscript and some Greek manuscripts say her son. The New American Bible says her son was given up. The New American Standard Bible says the one who sired her was given up, the father. The King James Margin says whom she brought forth, her son. So you see the split of opinion there. It's either her father or her son. Well, if it's her father, how was he given up? Well, her father was Ptolemy II Philadelphus, and he was given up because his alliance failed, even though he was dead. His alliance was killed. His daughter was killed. So he lost too, posthumously, you might say. But the most sense is the son was given up because the baby was killed too, little Antiochus III. Now there's one more person who was given up at the end of verse 6, the one who supported Berenice. Who is the one who supported Berenice? I'll give you four options. The first three by Gill. The first option as to the one who supported Berenice but was nonetheless given up is Berenice's former husband, Antiochus II Theos. Benson mentions that as an option, so does Gill mention that as an option. He's dead. He couldn't help her. He only formally supported her, but he did support her at some time. So the one who supported her, i.e. in the past, he's gone now. He's given up. That's option number one. Option number two, her father, Berenice's father, Ptolemy II Philadelphus. He was dead and could not help her. But even though he is now given over to death, he used to support her. In fact, Benson says so very fond of her he was that he took care continually to send her fresh supplies of the water of the Nile, thinking it better for her to drink of that than any other river. Well, that's option number two. Now, here's option number three as to who is this person who supported Berenice but was given up. Her brother, Ptolemy III Euergetes. John Gill mentions this as an option. He's on the throne in Egypt. He hears of Berenice's distress, his sister's distress, at Daphne where she is, so he sets out from Egypt for her relief, but came too late. She, Berenice, and her son were both already slain. I think that's the best answer. Here's a very weak answer, very weak option from Barnes, an unknown confidential advisor used to support her. No, we're not going to go with that one. I think it's her brother, Ptolemy III Euergetes. Euergetes means benefactor. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 7. In the place of the king of the south, one from her family will rise up, come against the army, and enter the fortress of the king of the north. He will take action against them and triumph. In the place of the king of the south, the king of the south had just died, Ptolemy II Philadelphus. He had died in 246. In the place of him, one from her family, that's Berenice's family, will rise up. Little translation issue about family. Some translations have one of her descendants will rise up, which makes absolutely no sense because that didn't happen. The NASB, for example, has descendants, and that's very confusing. Other translations have a shoot from her roots or a branch from her roots or a branch of her roots. ASV, Darby, God's Word has shoot from her roots. Bible in Basic English has branch from her roots. The King James has branch of her roots. Her roots are her ancestors. One branch was her, and one branch was her brother. One branch was Berenice, one branch was Ptolemy III, Euergetes. And so the Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as one from her family, which is the easiest way to read it. So one from her family will rise up, and as I said, the one who rose up is Ptolemy III, Euergetes. He was very unhappy about the murder of his sister, so he came against the army, and he entered the fortress of the king of the north. The fortress means the stronghold of the king of the north. Now that Ptolemy II Philadelphus and Antiochus II Theos have both died in 246, we enter into a new period of conflict between the north and the south. The southern king, who will take up most of our attention now, is Ptolemy II Euergetes, who ruled from 246 to 222. And in the Seleucid Empire, it's Seleucus II Callinicus, the son of Laodice. He ruled from 246 to 225. He had a son that lasted a couple of years, Seleucus III Soranus, the Thunderer, that's what that means. He ruled from 225 to 223. So we see almost an exact concurrence of reign dates here. Ptolemy Euergetes' reign was almost exactly contemporaneous with Seleucus II Callinicus and Seleucus I Callinicus' first son, Seleucus III Soranus. Euergetes dying in 222, Soranus dying in 223. So that is the conflict that we will be reading about now in Daniel. During that long contemporaneous reign, Ptolemy III Eurygetes beat the mud out of Seleucus II Callinicus. Callinicus means beautiful victory. Well, he wasn't much of a victor. I don't know how beautiful he was. Ptolemy III conquered territory from the Tigris River to Asia Minor. He was way out of Egypt. He will enter the fortress, Ptolemy III Eurygetes will, of the king of the north, Seleucus II Callinicus. Ptolemy III Eurygetes was even able to enter the city of Seleucia, which is a city about 20 miles southeast of modern Baghdad on the Tigris River. Ptolemy III Eurygetes left a garrison in Seleucia for 27 years. Now, John Gill says that perhaps not just Seleucia, but the cities of Syria were also taken by Ptolemy III Eurygetes. I'm sure they were, but they might have also been referred to here in Daniel. Enter the fortress of the king. John Gill says Ptolemy entered into Syria itself, as Polybius says, into the fortified cities of it, unless Seleucia itself is particularly designed, which Ptolemy seized and put a garrison of Egyptians in it, which held it 27 years. In other words, we know that Ptolemy III Eurygetes wiped out the king of the north in Seleucia and also other cities in Syria, so Seleucus II Callinicus the beautiful victor wasn't much of a victor. Daniel says at the end of verse 7, he will take action against them. Ptolemy II Philadelphus will take action against the people of the kings of the north, and he will triumph. He would have, in fact, conquered all of Seleucia, except that sedition back home made him return back to Egypt. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 8. He, this is Ptolemy III Eurygetes, 246 to 222, he will even take their gods captive to Egypt with their metal images and their precious articles of silver and gold. For some years he will stay away from the king of the north. Now Ptolemy III Eurygetes recovered many of the sacred statues that the Persian forces of Cambyses had carried off during their conquest of Egypt some 300 years earlier. Cambyses captured Egypt in 525. We're now past 246 somewhere. Jerome says it was 2,500 images that Ptolemy Eurygetes brought back from the Persian lands under the Seleucids. Because of Ptolemy III Eurygetes bringing back all these idols, he was known as Eurygetes, which means benefactor, because the Egyptians loved idols, so they put them back in their proper temples. These ancient kings always did that. That's just what they did. They would steal other gods from their temples to show that they had power over those gods and they had power over the people who worshiped those gods. Ptolemy III Eurygetes received 1,500 talents of silver annually as tribute. It constituted about 10% of his annual income. Jerome says he got 40,000 talents. I don't think people know exactly how much money he got, but he got a lot. Now, Seleucus II Callinicus, near the end of the reign of Ptolemy III Eurygetes, in 225, falls off his horse and dies. We read in verse 8 that Ptolemy III Eurygetes stayed away from Seleucus II Callinicus. I imagine it's because he's already conquered the territory. He's got the land, he's got their gold, he's got their gods, and that works, but the KJV translation gives an easier interpretation. Instead of stay away, the King James says he shall continue more years than the king of the north. And that's exactly what happened. Ptolemy III Eurygetes lasted all the way to 222 B.C. Seleucus II Callinicus fell off his horse in 225 B.C. So the Egyptian southern king, Ptolemy III, lasted three more years than the king of the north, Callinicus. And so when the King James says he should continue more years than the king of the north, the King James is exactly right. Here's some other translations backing up the KJV. Young's literal translation says he doth stand more years than the king of the north. Darby says he shall subsist for more years than the king of the north. God's word says he will rule for more years than the northern king. All true, and so I think that's probably the way we should take that. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 9. There's Seleucus II Callinicus, who will enter the kingdom of the south and then return to his own land. I say it's the king of the north, that's one option. Well, Callinicus, of course, is getting whipped all over the Seleucid Empire, so when did he try to enter the kingdom of Ptolemy III Eurygetes in the south? In 240 B.C., Seleucus II Callinicus attempted to invade Egypt, in response to the humiliation he had suffered at the hands of Ptolemy III Euergetes. He enters the kingdom and then he returns to his own land, Daniel says in verse 9. Why did he return? Because his fleet perished in a storm. That's why he returned. He utterly failed. Now, there's a textual note to look at here. The King James translates it differently. Instead of who, referring back to the king of the north, Seleucus II Callinicus, the King James says he. Actually, it doesn't say he. The King James says, so the king of the south. Explicitly, the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. That's not the same thing as saying the king of the north will enter the kingdom, as I just interpreted from the Holman Christian Study Bible. Well, if you take it the King James way, the king of the south shall come in, and if that's the true text, then what you have here is a mere summing up of the exploits of Ptolemy III Euergetes. He's finished whacking everybody in verse 8, and then at the end of verse 8, for some years he will stay away from the king of the north, and then he will enter the kingdom of the south and return to his own land. He's staying away from the north by going back to the south, and that's reasonable. However, I've got a lot of translations that back up the Holman Christian Study Bible and say it's the king of the north that tried to come into the king of the south. It was Callinicus trying to enter into the kingdom of Ptolemy III Euergetes. The ASV, the Bible in Basic English, the Darby Translation, God's Word, New American Bible, and the NASB. And so since there was an actual attempted invasion and it fits so well, we're going to take it that way. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 10. His sons will mobilize for war and assemble a large number of armed forces. They will advance, sweeping through like a flood, and will again wage war as far as his fortress. Whose sons will mobilize for war? Well, that's the sons of Seleucus II Callinicus, who ruled from 246 to 225. The oldest of the sons was Seleucus III Soranus, which is Greek for thunder. His thunder didn't last too long. He only reigned for 2 years, from 225 to 223. He's also known as Seleucus III Soteras, Savior. He didn't save anybody. He was the eldest son of Seleucus II Callinicus, and he tried to wage war against Egyptian provinces in Asia Minor, sort of a colonial proxy war. He was unsuccessful. So unsuccessful, in fact, he was assassinated by his troops in Asia Minor in 223 B.C., and so we are not going to hear too much more about Mr. Thunder, Seleucus III Soranus. But now his younger brother takes over. He's the second son of Seleucus II Callinicus. And Antiochus III the Great, as he came to be called, ruled from 223 to 187. So we can see that right at the end of Ptolemy III Euergetes, who died in 222, right at the end of his reign, these two sons, these two brothers, were working together, raising a large army to try to beat their father's old enemy, Ptolemy III Euergetes. Now, Antiochus III the Great, not many people have been called the Great. He basically spent all of his life reconquering defected provinces from Seleucia, like the Medes and the Persians, and also fighting the Ptolemies. He's an interesting-looking guy. He's got a real worried look on his face, a real sad, somber look, and his face is real tall and skinny. He takes over in 225 at the age of 18 and reigned 37 years. He retook the Seleucia on the Tigris River, not the one at the end of the Orontes, port of Antioch, that's Seleucus Piera. And, as we'll see, he marched victoriously through Judah all the way to the border of Egypt between 219 and 218 B.C. Now, his brother had helped him amass a great army until his brother got assassinated. Mr. Thunder, Seleucus III Soranus, got assassinated, and so Antiochus III got a hold of that army. His goal was to retake land in Syria that had been taken by Ptolemy III Euergetes, who had just basically been whipping up on the Seleucids for all of his reign. So let me read you what Barnes says. Ptolemy, that's Ptolemy III Euergetes, marched into Syria with an army of 70,000 foot, 5,000 horse, and 73 elephants, and was met by Antiochus. Wikipedia says this was in 222, right at the end of his life, at the end of Ptolemy Euergetes' reign. So Antiochus meets Ptolemy III with an army of 62,000 foot, 6,000 horse, and 102 elephants. In a great battle, Antiochus was defeated and returned to Antioch. So Ptolemy III ended his reign on a high note. But the following year, Antiochus III the Great rallied his forces and invaded Syria, took Gaza and the other strongholds, and subdued the whole country of Syria, including Palestine, to himself. And so that's why Daniel says that they, meaning the troops, not necessarily, well, it can't be the two sons, because one of the sons has died, Mr. Thunder had already died, they will advance sweeping through like a flood. And that's what Antiochus III did. He swept through like a flood. Now let's look at that pronoun, they will advance, sweeping through like a flood. It's interesting because the Young's literal translation has the translation this way. His sons stir themselves up and have gathered a multitude of great forces. And he hath certainly come in and overflowed and passed through. And he turns back. Instead of they, it's got he. That makes more sense because Seleucus III Saronus has already died, leaving only Antiochus the Great. But if you're going to insist on translating it as they, then you'll have to say the members of the troops, the armed forces of the army that was gathered, because Seleucus III Saronus has already died. So we see in 222, Ptolemy III Euergetes won a great victory over Antiochus III the Great, but Antiochus III waits a year and takes the land back and flows all over Syria, Israel, Phoenicia too, all the way down to the southern border of Israel, present-day Gaza, the border of Egypt. Now, as I said, 222 was the last year of Ptolemy III Euergetes, and so the only contact that Antiochus III had with him was to get beat by him. But now, Antiochus III, the great competitor in the dynasty of the Ptolemies, is Ptolemy IV Philopater. Now, Ptolemy IV Philopater means father lover. He ruled between 221 and 204, and so Antiochus Epiphanes lived long past him. Antiochus Epiphanes went all the way down to 187. So this is going to be the main conflict now. Ptolemy IV Philopater, the father lover, against Antiochus III the Great in the north. Now, verse 10 says that Antiochus III the Great passed through or overflowed, depending on the translation, swept through like a flood, all the way down to his fortress. What is his fortress? It could be Gaza. The Cambridge commentator says it's probably Gaza because it was the most important fortress of Palestine on the south, and it had been strong, proved itself strong, because it had resisted Alexander the Great for 2 months. That could be. Pulpit commentator says it could be Seleucia. I assume that's Seleucia Piera. Pulpit commentator also mentions another option, Pelusium, which is further south and west of Raphia, further deep into Egypt. I don't think so. I think it's Raphia, which Benson affirms and Poole affirms. That was a big city. That was the main city there, guarding the entry into Egypt from that direction of Egypt's northeast. Poole says it belonged to Egypt for a border protection. I'm assuming it belonged to Egypt at this time. Site of a famous battle there, which is not going to happen until 217. We're now around 219 and 218. As Antiochus III flows over, sweeps through like a flood all the way down to Raphia, as far as his fortress. This sweeping through is through Syria, by the way, not Egypt, of course, as Barnes says. Wikipedia says that Antiochus III began the Fourth Syrian War in 219 BC. Antiochus III recaptured Seleucia Piraea, as well as cities in Phoenicia, amongst them Tyre. Wikipedia also says the campaigns of 219 BC and 218 BC carried the Seleucid armies almost to the confines of the Ptolemaic kingdom. Okay, probably to Rapha. Also, by the way, we might point out that Antiochus III also took Rabbath Ammon, which is the capital of present-day Jordan, about 40 miles east of Jerusalem. So we move now to Daniel 11:11. Infuriated, the king of the south will march out to fight with the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but they will be handed over to his enemy. Now the king of the south is Ptolemy IV Philopater. As I said, he ruled from 221 to 205. He was Ptolemy III Euergetes' son, that king having died in 222. Ptolemy IV Philopater was a lazy, indolent man. He was called Philopater, which is rather an ironic title. It means father lover, but Philopater had killed his father, mother, and his brother. So Philopater comes out to march to fight with the king of the north, that's Antiochus III. That occurred at the Battle of Raphia, 217 BC. That's sometimes called the Battle of Gaza. Ptolemy IV Philopater won that battle, even though Antiochus III had raised a large army, as we said earlier. However, they, the large army, will be handed over to Antiochus III's enemy, namely Ptolemy IV Philopater. So Antiochus III got a butt whooping at the Battle of Raphia, 217. His large army, one source says, contained 70,000 infantry and 5,000 cavalry. Another source says that 10,000 of Antiochus's army were slain and 4,000 were made captive. After that severe defeat, Antiochus III retires to Lebanon. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 12. Daniel says this, "When the army is carried off, he will become arrogant and cause tens of thousands to fall, but he will not triumph." When whose army is carried off? That's the army of Antiochus III the Great, as I just mentioned. It was a horrible disaster for them. They lost Raphia in 217. He, who is the he, that's Ptolemy IV Philopater, he became arrogant after he won that battle in 217. He caused tens of thousands to fall. Well, first of all, let's take his arrogance. Matthew Henry says that Ptolemy IV Philopater went into the temple at Jerusalem and, in defiance of the law, entered the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, which, of course, that's a big no-no. It's a miracle God didn't kill him. That is an interesting factoid, which I haven't really noticed before. I think lots of times pagans entered into the Holy of Holies to defame it, and they weren't struck dead. But if a Jewish priest did it at the wrong time, ha-wham! Maybe God's standards weren't quite as high for the unlearned Gentiles. But at any rate, Ptolemy IV, instead of, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, following up his victory, instead of doing that by making himself master of the whole of Syria, he made peace with Antiochus and gave himself up to licentiousness and profaned the temple of God by entering the holy place. Now, you know, when people support armies, they have to pay taxes. They support the army by putting their loved ones in the army, and they get killed. And if an army wins a battle, it's expected to reap the spoils. But instead, Philopater's too lazy to do anything about it, and he's just sitting around playing video games. This is what Adam Clark says. Had Ptolemy improved his victory, he might have dispossessed Antiochus of his old empire. But giving way to pride and a criminally sensual life, he made peace on dishonorable terms. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say this. He shall lose the power gained by his victory through his luxurious indolence. So that's how we can remember Ptolemy IV Philopater. He loved his father so much he killed him, and he was a Sybarite. He loved luxury. Now we got one more item to deal with in verse 12. Ptolemy IV Philopater caused tens of thousands to fall. When did he do that? Two options. He killed 10,000 Jews when he went up to Jerusalem after winning at Raphia in 217. Benson says it appears from Eusebius that about this time 40,000 Jews, or according to Jerome, 60,000 were slain. Well, that makes sense. However, option number two is that this verse in Daniel is referring to all the soldiers of Antiochus III's army that fell at Raphia. Ellicott, Cambridge, and Pulpit all say that. Tens of thousands fell at the great battle of Raphia. I don't know what I think about that. That sounds like a 50-50 proposition to me. We move now to Daniel chapter 11, verse 13. The king of the north will again raise a multitude larger than the first. After some years, he will advance with a great army and many supplies. That, of course, is Antiochus III the Great, licking his wounds after Raphia. He will raise a multitude larger than the first. Remember, the first one was already pretty big, the one that got beat at Raphia. He's going to raise an even bigger army. Gill says some say it consisted of 300,000 footmen besides horsemen and elephants. Now, this military preparation took place, Daniel says in verse 13, after some years. The Fifth Syrian War, which is being referred to here, began in 202. Raphia's in 217, so we're talking about 15 years later. The Fifth Syrian War lasted between 202 and 195 B.C. During this war, Antiochus III the Great swept down into Judea from Syria. He retook the land he had lost about 15 years earlier, after the Battle of Raphia. So he's sitting pretty, but one winter he withdrew, and Scopas, the Egyptian commander, reoccupied Israel, and so Israel was lost again to Antiochus III the Great. Now we're down to 202, the Fifth Syrian War. Ptolemy IV Philopater has died in 204 or so. After Ptolemy IV, father lover, died in 204, he left his son, Ptolemy V Epiphanes. And Epiphany is when a god is manifest, so Ptolemy V manifested God. He ruled from 204 to 180. Antiochus III died in 187, so this is the second king that Antiochus III has got to deal with. Ptolemy IV and Ptolemy V, father and son, that's the opponents of Antiochus III. Now this boy, he was only a boy of 5 years old when he takes over. He was a little minor king. I say a minor king, I mean he is a minor who is a king. And that means there has to be a regent, and the regents always squabble and so forth. And Antiochus says, oh, a minority, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to take advantage of this. And so Antiochus entered into a league with Philip, king of Macedon. Now, this is not Alexander the Great's father, of course. That was a long time ago. This is another Philip. And the idea is they were going to take the kingdom of Egypt away from Ptolemy V Epiphanes, and they were going to divide it up between Philip and Antiochus III. And so this league conquered Coele-Syria, that's Lebanon, between the two mountain ranges, and also Palestine, present-day Israel. And so, even though they had lost Israel when Scopas, the Egyptian commander, reoccupied Israel, they lost it again, the Ptolemies did, when the alliance of Antiochus III, the Great, and Philip got Lebanon and Israel back again. So at this stage of the peace, the Syrians, the Seleucids, are on top. We go now to Daniel 11, verse 14. In those times, many will rise up against the king of the south. Violent ones among your own people will assert themselves to fulfill a vision, but they will fail. Many will rise up against Ptolemy V Epiphanes. That's the king of the south. Who are these many? Well, of course, there's the forces of Philip of Macedon, who had allied themselves with Antiochus the Great. Barnes, Benson, John Calvin, and the pulpit commentary say that that's who the many are who have risen up against Ptolemy V Epiphanes. But also, option number two, this is from Barnes, there were rebels in Egypt who fought against Ptolemy V Epiphanes on the domestic front. Remember, he's just a little boy. This is what John Gill says, Agathocles and Agathoclea, favorites of the former king of Egypt, Ptolemy IV, these two laid a scheme of taking the regency into their hands during the minority of the young king. These, being persons of dissolute lives, were hated by the Egyptians, which caused insurrections and seditions among themselves. Typical situation with a regency. The Egyptian general Scopas even was thinking about taking over the government. The Cambridge commentator says that the many who will rise up against Ptolemy V Epiphanes were both the forces of Philip of Macedon and Antiochus the Great, and the rebels in Egypt who were fighting over the regency. At any rate, Ptolemy V, God manifest, is having problems. Now Daniel says, back in verse 14, here in verse 14, he says, violent ones among your own people will assert themselves. That, of course, is the Jews, your own people, the people of Daniel, the people of the Jews. When did this happen? Well, there were a section of Jews who willingly yielded to Antiochus the Great. In the Fifth Syrian War, they joined with him, helping him to besiege Ptolemy V's garrisons there in the Promised Land. They helped Antiochus III, the Great's army, by giving them provisions. This occurred when Antiochus III, the Great, was returning from Egypt, and he besieged the Egyptian garrison, which the Egyptians had left in Jerusalem, and these Jews helped out Antiochus the Great. Now, they had a vision. They will assert themselves to fulfill a vision. What's this vision that these Jews had? Option number one is they wanted independence from Ptolemy V Epiphanes, and so they supported Antiochus III. Option number two is quite different. I'll get to that in a minute. Let's take the most obvious option. They wanted independence from Ptolemy V Epiphanes. This is Barnes. This is Benson's view. Let me read you what Barnes says. In these times, they were alternately under the dominion of the Egyptian and the Syrian monarchs of Ptolemy V Epiphanes, ruled 204 to 180, and of Antiochus III the Great, ruled 223 to 187. The principal seat of the wars between Syria and Egypt was Palestine, the borderland between them, and Judea, therefore, often changed masters. Ptolemy Philopater had subdued Coele-Syria and Palestine, and Ptolemy Epiphanes came into possession of them when he ascended the throne. Philopater, remember, is Ptolemy Epiphanes V's father. But the angel now says that a portion of his people would take occasion, that's Gabriel, says that a portion of his people would take occasion, a portion of the Jews would take occasion from the weakness of the youthful monarch of Egypt, that's Ptolemy V Epiphanes, and the conspiracies in his own kingdom, and the foreign combinations against him, that would include Philip of Macedon, to attempt to throw off his authority and to become independent. And this Jewish faction preferred Antiochus III the Great more than they liked Ptolemy V Epiphanes. Well, why did this vision fail of establishing Antiochus III the Great as the ruler of Israel? As Barnes says, it failed because Israel did not gain its independence. Barnes says, Israel did not even gain permanent separation from Egyptian rule. Benson says, quote, for Scopas came with a powerful army from Ptolemy V Epiphanes, and Antiochus being engaged in other parts, Scopas soon reduced the cities of Coelesyria, that's Lebanon and Syria, and Palestine to their former obedience. He subdued the Jews in the winter season, placed a garrison in the castle of Jerusalem, and returned with great spoils to Alexandria. So now Ptolemy V has got charge of Israel. You see how Israel is a football going back and forth between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. Now, there is another option to fulfill this phrase of Daniel in verse 14, violent ones among your own people will assert themselves to fulfill a vision. This option that I'm going to give you is favored by Adam Clark and John Calvin. There was a Jew named Onias. He took Jewish exiles to On, which is Heliopolis, which is just north of Cairo. It's a suburb of Cairo, basically in the north. These Jewish exiles came to build a temple. They were trying to fulfill the vision, quote-unquote, in Isaiah 19:19, which reads this way, on that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the center of the land of Egypt and a pillar to the Lord near her border. Now, Calvin says that the source of this story is Josephus and the Book of Maccabees, and according to those sources, Onias was honorably received by Ptolemy V Epiphanes, and Ptolemy V Epiphanes gave Onias permission to build a temple in On, also known as Heliopolis, right where the seven branches of the Nile come together and into the main trunk of the Nile. Now, why did this vision fail, if this is the true vision that's being talked about here? Well, it failed because the temple was never established. But that's sort of out of context here. Violent ones among your own people will assert themselves to fulfill a vision. If the vision is to pick a winner in the Fifth Syrian War, that's right in the middle of what we're talking about. We're talking about the Fifth Syrian War, and they were trying to pick Antiochus III as a winner, and they failed to do it because Ptolemy V ended up being in charge. We go now to Daniel 11:15, and we will finish this long audio. Then the king of the north will come, build up an assault ramp, and capture a well-fortified city. The forces of the south will not stand. Even their select troops will not be able to resist. Ah, so now the pendulum swings back to Antiochus III the Great, because he's going to come. It says he's going to build an assault ramp and capture. It says he's going to build up an assault ramp and capture a well-fortified city. Now, that well-fortified city, by common agreement, is Sidon. Well, what has that got to do with what's going on? Well, what happened was Scopas went to Sidon to escape Antiochus the Great because Antiochus the Great had come and defeated Scopas, the Egyptian general, at Peneus, which is the headwaters of the Jordan River. It was called Caesarea Philippi in the Gospels. I've been there. It's a neat little place. Got caves there with old pagan idols still in the caves. Beautiful scenery. The Jordan River is just a little couple streams bubbling up through a marsh. Well, so Scopas got beat, and he heads to Sidon, holes up in Sidon. So Antiochus III the Great then besieges Sidon. Scopas surrenders in 199 B.C. He surrendered in return for safe passage back to Egypt. The troops gave up their weapons. They left the city naked and walked back to Egypt. And so now Antiochus III is in charge of the Holy Land. The forces of the south, the forces of Ptolemy V Epiphanes, will not stand, says Daniel in verse 15. Even their select troops will not be able to resist. These troops will not stand. The pulpit commentator says Ptolemy sent several successive armies to relieve Sidon, but was unable to compel Antiochus to give up the siege. Finally, Scopas had to surrender. That was in 199 B.C. The King James has Antiochus III Epiphanes captured fenced cities, plural, instead of a well-fortified city. And I don't know about the translation, but it is true that Antiochus did take many garrisoned cities in the Holy Land besides Sidon. So now the pendulum is swung back to the north, and now the Syrians are in control of the Promised Land. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished. with Daniel 11, verses 1 through 15. I hope you stay with me as we continue with the Syrian wars in verses 16 through 30 in our next audio. And I hope you enjoyed this audio.